G'day everyone, new weekly update which I'm going to jump straight into because I'm actually doing this in the afternoon, which is a bit unusual, and I've got about 50 minutes until I got to go to a meeting, and I would like to try and keep this one within 50 minutes, but there is a lot of stuff. So I'm doing this, first of all, doing this in the afternoon my time because I just got off a plane from Sydney. So I was down in Sydney the last 2 days. So for those of you from outside of Australia, Sydney is about an hour and a quarter flight here from the Gold Coast. So it's like the easiest flight ever in the world, particularly because our airports are pretty cruisy in terms of just walking in. I mean, we do all the security stuff, but yeah, walking through the front door, through security, into the terminal, job done. So a nice and easy trip here when I do these in Oz. So I did a total of 4 talks in a day and a tiny bit. So the way this worked out is I got invited down to the ADAPT conference, which was a conference with a lot of people in suits. Now, very, very nice people. I don't mean this in a derogatory fashion, but it was a different audience to many of the events I go to. So the ADAPT conference had a lot of CISOs there. So people who are in sort of more senior decision-making roles as it relates to InfoSec. I hope there were a bunch of people as well who were, yeah, possibly not just security orientated, but were realizing that maybe this is a good thing to be thinking about today. So that was the purpose of the event. The talks I did is I did a talk at the SSW user group on Wednesday night. Now, this was sort of poignant actually because the penny dropped for me just before I did it. SSW is, well, it did stand for Superior Software for Windows, but I don't think they call it that anymore. It was a very long time ago they coined that name. Run by a good mate of mine called Adam Cogan, who's another regional director and someone I've known for a very long time. And that the penny that dropped was the very first public talk I ever did was for Adam at SSW. And that was back in 2012 somewhere. And in fact, if you go to my blog and you go /recorded-talks, the very first one, which is down the bottom because reverse chronology, that one there is the very first one I ever did. So that was kind of cool to go back there and do another talk. It was live streamed. It was recorded. You'll see it pop up on SSW TV somewhere. It was a very kind of casual off-the-cuff talk. I did a little bit of one of the sort of presentations I have been doing a bit of lately. And then a bunch of just random stuff that people wanted to do. Things like SRI, some CSP demos, some HSTS stuff, various things. So did that. Then I did the ADAPT talk yesterday morning, which was Thursday morning. I went down there and spent a bunch of time with Pluralsight as well. So I sort of represented them and spoke on their behalf. So we had a nice lunch yesterday with a select group of Pluralsight customers. So some really lovely people there where we had some very interesting talks about the cybers, which was cool. And then I did another talk after that from, well, it was about 3:30 to 5:30 in the afternoon at a pub in Sydney with, I think we probably had 40 people, 50 people, something like that, that came along. And I did a lot of the same stuff as SSW. Did that and then went out with about half a dozen of those guys and had some very nice beers, which was a very good way to finish that. So it was funny because I was talking to the folks as we were having beers and eating pizzas and sort of that sort of thing. This is kind of the nice thing about those events, right? It's not necessarily doing the talks. I mean, it's fun doing the talks, but it's having the opportunity to actually connect with people, because the rest of the time I'm like sitting here on my own. And don't get me wrong, it's very nice here. I like it, but it does get a little bit insular. I say this as I'm sitting here talking to myself on a camera, but you get what I mean. So that was really good. I flew back this morning. Now, I've got 2 major things to speak about this week. And the first one is the data breach that I loaded into Have I Been Pwned yesterday morning. And this is a data breach called Exactus. Now, let me give you the background on Exactus, and then we'll talk about just how I think many people feel about this company. So, last month, there was a big news story about Exactus. Now, I'm just going to look at my monitor here as well, because I want to make sure I get all of my pieces of information right, because I'm very careful, particularly when we're talking about data breaches. I do not want to screw stuff up. So there is a Wired piece, there's a Wired magazine piece, and I'm going to put this in the notes for this particular podcast. And this Wired piece ran 26th of June last month. And there's a security researcher called Vinny Troyer, Apologies if I have murdered your last name, Vinny, T-R-O-I-A. Now, here's a bloke who found quite a lot of data exposed, a couple of terabytes worth of data from a company called Exactus. Now, how do we describe this kind of... Yeah, let's do this, just to take any sort of subjectivity out of it. Let's go to Exactus. This is, and again, I'll put the link in the notes, E-X-A-C-T-I-S. We'll go to their website, I'll explain what they do. People data for a digital world. Exactus is a leading compiler and aggregator of premium business and consumer data with over 3.5 billion records updated monthly. Our universal data warehouse is one of the largest and most respected in the digital and direct marketing industry. You with me so far? Now, what are their services? Because this is right about now, you might be starting to say, "Oh, this sounds a bit odd." Its services include data enhancement, better understand your customers, data appending, add. So, all right, now this is an interesting term. Now, just so I don't get sued or anything, like this is my interpretation of what it says. Data impending, appending, as in adding to. Add demographics, lifestyle, and purchase data. Because what this sounds like is you might have customers and they have certain records, and Exactus can give you more information about the customers, i.e. append. Now, having seen the data that we're going to talk about in a moment, this sounds like a reasonable explanation. Increase your customer file, clean and organize your file. Is your customer data yielding maximum results in identifying buyer traits, increasing lifetime value, or finding new customers? And it sort of goes on and on and on. And to sort of cut to the point, Exactus has a shitload of data on a heap of people who never gave it to them. Like there's no way of sugarcoating it. That's what it is, a huge amount of data. When this particular breach happened, and it was in the news, Wired magazine was talking about 340 million records. And that is obviously quite a lot. The story was very US-centric. It was very much around 340 million Americans. Now, if I'm going to check my figures now, because probably an American going, hang on a moment, there are not many that many people there. I thought that was around about the entire population of the US. Entire population of the US is estimated at 328 million. So maybe some non-US people in there. We're going to get back to that because that does turn out to be the case. So a lot of people in there. Now, Vinny and I have been chatting a little bit around notifying impacted parties. Because here's the problem. When you've got a data aggregator, and let's be clear, we have seen data aggregators breached before. There's been things like the Dun & Bradstreet Net Prospect stuff where they leaked a whole bunch of data. We've seen a lot of other marketing lists, for people listening on the podcast, I'm air quoting that, marketing lists used for things like spam purposes. There's a bunch of those on Have I Been Pwned Too. So seeing these things happen before, when this happens, the company involved, first of all, is, I was going to say usually American, but it's not always, because we had the South African Master Deeds thing where it's like everyone in the country, their data was collected too. But this is something that happens a lot in the US, these sorts of services. Now, when it happens, the company involved is probably not going to do much responsible disclosure. And inevitably, this is the case. So everyone that I've heard to from since I loaded this data has said, look, we never got told about this. You know, I saw it in the news, never knew my data was in there. So Vinny and I were chatting, and I said, look, basically, how are people going to know? Like, how are people going to find out that their data was exposed? And he ended up saying, look, let's do this via Have I Been Pwned. I'm going to give you a slice of the data. And think about a vertical slice. So in other words, I don't have all the columns. So I have the email address and a couple of other pretty typical attributes that are in most data breaches. There's a heap of other stuff I do not have. Now, I want to talk to you about what was in there. Vinny did send me one sample record because I needed to understand the entire scope so I could add the metadata attributes to Have I Been Pwned to the description. So actually, let's do it this way. In Have I Been Pwned, if I look at this Exactus data breach, it's the number one there in recently added breaches. The data attributes, I don't show that there, do I? Let's go to Who's Been Pwned and find Exactus. The data attributes, this is the most data attributes I think I've ever had in a breach. They include, and this is just Have I Been Pwned's metadata, credit card information. No, let me actually very carefully rephrase that, because as soon as credit cards are involved, people get very, very sensitive. Credit status information. Dates of birth, education levels, email addresses, ethnicities, family structure, financial investments, genders, home ownership statuses, income levels, IP addresses, marital statuses, names, net worth, occupations, personal interests, phone numbers, physical addresses, religions, spoken languages. That's a shitload of data, right? So that is a massive, massive set of information. Now, so this is like my generic categories that I use for Have I Been Pwned. Alarmingly, every single category I needed was also already in Have I Been Pwned, because there's been other data breaches. When you look at the paste bin with the data that Vinny sent me that one record for, I went through and redacted anything that's possibly personally identifiable. I just left the guy's first name, Richard. Richard has had a bad time of it. I'm going to link to this in the notes for this blog post. But other than those groups that I just sent you, I'm just trying to sort of strip this down. We've got things like longitude and latitude that may well have been generated from the address information. It's stuff like estimated income code, home owner probability model, length of residence code, number of persons living in unit, 5 people living in Richard's unit apparently, presence of children, yes, number of children, 4. And then we've got each of the children, child, 0-2, and then we've got a lot of U's in here, so this may indicate unidentified, but then we've got some Y's in some columns. So we've got stuff like children age 6 to 10, children age 6 to 10 male, and it goes on and on and on. There's over 400 lines here. We've got genders here. We've got inferred household rank, not sure what we're ranking here, whether there's an American Express card, presence of UPS scale retail card. These, incidentally, are not camel cased. So there was all just lowercase, which does make it a little bit hard to read. Computer owner, yes or no? Gee, do I even have to ask that anymore? Are they into photography, cats, dogs, pets? Are they a smoker? Do they like jewelry or luggage? And inevitably, these are profiling things that have come from various multiple sources. It's really worth a look at this paste bin, because honestly, when I started looking at this the other day, when I saw that sample record, I just went, oh my God, like this is, whoever thought this was a good idea? And then like, this is a bit where I want to get a bit cranky about it, because it just blows my mind that there are organizations that can operate legally. And I bet you the defense from this organization is going to be, well, we're operating legally. And if they can do that, well then shame on the jurisdiction that allows them to do it. Incidentally, that jurisdiction, I believe, is Florida in the US. It blows my mind that they can collect all this data, obviously without any consent. So we're going to talk about GDPR, yeah, don't worry about that. Collect all this data without any consent. And in fact, you know, look, GDPR aside, it's a dick thing to do, all right? Like if you're collecting data on anyone, I don't care where they are in the world, and they haven't allowed you to have that information, you're building up massive profiles, scraping all sorts of things from them, including allegedly, multiple people who replied after they got their Have I Been Pwned notifications and said, the only place I've used that email address is in LinkedIn, and it was in the LinkedIn data breach. So this has possibly, lots of caveats here, possibly been enriched by data breaches as well, which is kind of alarming. And look, I mean, we certainly know that that would be a very attractive source of information, because there's a lot of very sensitive personal information data breaches. But bear that as it may, this company's put all this data together. They left it exposed to the internet. Vinny found it, obviously went through all the disclosures and everything and got it locked up before it became public knowledge. Now, after I loaded in, a number of different things have happened, which is what makes this quite interesting now. So one of those things is, lots of people who are not very American got emails saying that they'd been in the breach. Even a mate of mine in Sydney got an email, said, hey, you've been in the breach. There's a very good friend of mine I've known for 18 years or something. And he's a tech guy, and he was obviously very curious as to how his information was spreading. So as part of the verification process, we actually went through and had a look at his record. Everything except for his email address was wrong. So that's the only one individual that I've confirmed data with. It may well be that there's loads of other people in there that have accurate data, and certainly the Wired magazine piece did talk about people having accurate data that was verified. His data was wrong. So as far as sort of high quality, enriched, yada, 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 there's definitely going to be false positives in there. And in fairness to Exactus, I don't know why I'm saying fairness, but anyway, in fairness to them, any sort of mass aggregation of data is going to have quality issues. It just has to at some point. So that is that's a bit of an issue, the fact that there are other email addresses in there from other countries. Now, that, of course, has invoked many tweets about GDPR, and many people have now made subject access requests to Exactus. And an SAR is one of the constructs within GDPR where you can say, look, I would like to have access to my data. And like, this is quite a reasonable thing to ask. You know, you guys have collected and stored all this data on me. What is it? The Wired piece says that Exactus weren't exactly returning phone calls. I don't think people are going to get responses from them. I like the fact that you're thinking, you know, go out there and ask for data. And as I said many times before, I think in many ways we almost need to sort of put GDPR aside and say, well, look, what is the right thing to do in situations like this? And the right thing to do would be for the company to reply. Even going back to the Ashley Madison stuff, people would ask me for their data from the breach, and I'd say, well, the right thing to do would be for them to give it to you, so why don't you ask them? So it's the right thing to do, but I don't think they're going to get a reply. Now, I'm going to try and think about a way to explain this without dropping myself in it. You will get it if you do this search. You will understand what I mean. One of the things that I've been trying to work out in the very, very small amount of time I've had, because I have, you know, been doing the travel stuff, is a little bit more about this organization. You may find it interesting to Google the CEO of Exactus. The CEO of Exactus is a guy called Steve Hardigree. That's Steve, S-T-E-V-E, Hardigree, H-A-R-D-I-G-R-E-E. He's in Florida. And I just leave it at that. So, see how you go with that. Now, just getting back to the GDPR thing for a moment and the subject access request. This, by any reasonable measure, assuming it does actually include legitimate data on folks in Europe, this, by any reasonable measure, is precisely the sort of thing that we want GDPR to put a stop to. We want to put a stop to it anyway, but GDPR is probably going to be the thing with the biggest teeth to be able to do it. I don't think people are going to get responses to SARs. I think it probably requires more than that. If people in Europe want to run with this, I would be really interested to see where it goes, because I think we need some precedents of organizations being held to account when this sort of stuff happens. If anyone is organizing things along those lines, get in touch with me. Okay, so I want to sort of leave Exactus there, because I do have something else that I want to talk about, and that's probably going to take up the next half an hour that I've got. So, have I mentioned HTTPS lately? Now, this is the week that we have been waiting for, because it's Chrome 68 week. So Chrome 68 hit, was it yesterday morning? Maybe the morning before, because our geographies and everything are a little bit upside down here. Very, very recently. And of course, one of the things that Chrome 68, or the thing which Chrome 68 is going to be so famous for, is flagging non-secure sites as not secure. Now, again, before anyone listens to this and loses their minds, it is the connection that's not secure. If you're worried about the nomenclature, click on the bit that says not secure, and it says, mind you, I was just going to say, I've got to find a site that's not secure now. Scripting.com, that's not secure. Another story. Click on not secure. It says, your connection to this site is not secure. You should not enter any sensitive information on this site, for example, passwords or credit cards, because it could be stolen by attackers. Learn more. Now, so we're now explicitly flagging not secure connections as not secure, which brings it to parity with secure connections. Now, let me explain what I mean by that, because this is important. We have, since forever until sometime this week, defaulted to not secure connections not saying anything. Secure connections, on the other hand, have said secure, because secure is special. And it's special insofar as it has not been normal. It has been an exceptional situation. Now, I think about this in three phases, right? So we had this phase which went from somewhere in the mid-90s through until still today, which is that secure connections stay secure. Now, we now have this period where both secure connections and not secure connections say what they are. Secure or not secure. Just totally explicitly explaining it. The final phase in this, I think, maybe, look, who knows what's going to be final, but the next major phase is going to be secure connections not saying anything because secure becomes normal. And Google have well and truly indicated that this is on the radar too. And it makes sense when you think about it. You know, like, why do you need to flag something which is normal, which should be default, which people should expect to see? Let's instead flag the exception. So let's flag the abnormal stuff. I'm just looking under my meeting pop-up reminders somehow managed to go directly behind the camera. That's okay. So in the future, we will see HTTPS not flagged as anything and HTTP probably flagged a little bit more obviously than now. So for example, it might go red in the future. In fact, you've been able to turn that on via Chrome flags for quite some time. All right, so it hit. Now, I think I mentioned last week, I might have hinted last week what we're going to do. But Scott Helm and I wanted to do a little project where we highlight the world's largest websites that don't do HTTPS. And the original plan was very good. The original plan was Scott does this Alexa 1 million crawl every night. And he identifies which sites are loaded over HTTPS, which are HTTP, which ones have HSTS, which ones have CSP, which ones have all sorts of other security constructs that we regularly use. Every 6 months he does a report. Now, he and I were chatting last week, and we said, wouldn't it be cool if we just took that nightly report, fed it straight onto a website, and then the website just told you the top 100 sites, for example, that aren't HTTPS, and then you could divide it down by country as well, because that tends to get a lot more interest when you localize things. Data's already out there. It'll be easy. We'll knock it up in an afternoon. Job done. Everybody happy. Not so easy. So here is why it is not so easy. We're going to talk about multiple things here. First thing is, and this is that there's a big blog post on this. First thing is that depending on where you are in the world, what browser you have, possibly which way the wind is blowing as well, because these things are very, very erratic, you may or may not be able to make an HTTP request to a host name and get redirected to a secure connection. Let me give you multiple examples of that. The Home Affairs Office, Department of Home Affairs in Australia, was one of the most obvious Australian ones that popped up as not secure. And when I saw that, I was like, oh boy, this is going to get press. And subsequently has gotten press. I'm going to need to check my facts here very carefully. And I checked them by going to the browser and typing in the HTTP address, and I got redirected to HTTPS. And I'm going, look, Scott, dude, your figures are bad. You know, like somehow your crawler has had a hiccup. So Scott, because he's a very evidence-based guy, said, here's the evidence. It has not had a hiccup. In fact, what it's returned is like a page under maintenance page or a site under maintenance page over HTTP. And then we had a very long philosophical debate. Now, I started out from the perspective, I actually started out from one perspective and then came around to his point of view. So I started with the perspective that, look, if the site is configured to redirect requests and there's just some exceptional circumstances where it doesn't, well, it probably shouldn't be on the list. Scott was a little bit more hard-nosed about it and sort of made the point that, well, if my crawler can make requests to it and it doesn't redirect, then other people could possibly make requests to it and it doesn't redirect. Now, also, his crawler sends all normal browser user agent headers and everything, so his crawler making a request is indistinguishable from a browser making a request. So that was his point. My big concern, I'm going to get some figures here. My big concern was that if we have what is perceived to be false positives, people will lose confidence in the list. We knew it was going to get a lot of press. I didn't want journos writing it up going, hey, these two glars wrote this site and now all this stuff is incorrect. So I was very worried about that. So what I ended up doing is after I distilled everything down to the top 100 websites and then I took the top 100 for every country as well, what we ended up with is a total of 0.45% of domains which did actually respond with a 301 to a 301 or a 302 to HTTPS. So when I saw that, I went, okay, putting it in perspective, like there's less than 1 in 200 websites, which when I go to them now in a browser, don't do what the crawler says. But Scott's kind of right in that we can't have this situation where there are some circumstances where the site does actually reply over HTTP and there are other circumstances where it doesn't. And then we sort of go, oh, it gets it right some of the time, that's okay. Because what we really should be saying is just get it right consistently. Yeah, that's what we're after. Get it right consistently. So that's the call we decided to make. And the other thing here as well is that if we had have started making exceptions where we say, look, there's this automated process, but us humans will come in and then override it, that just starts to set a precedent that's going to be hard to maintain, because ultimately we will automate the scans updating the sites as well. And we can't have this situation where we're continually called in to sort of fix what people perceive as false positives. Be that as it may, a lot of people in the comments and on the Twitters and so on as well have contacted us and said, I just tested this, it redirects to HTTPS. Now, there are multiple different circumstances which then led to this. So many of them I went through, I went and just curled it from the command line, came back with a 200. So look, dude, maybe it does redirect for you, doesn't redirect for me, it stays on the list, read the blog post, it's explained there. So there's that. There's also a situation where some sites have fixed it. So some sites have already said, you were right, we've fixed it. I would like to get them off this list as fast as possible because we should be celebrating the success that they've had. This is really good news. Well done. This is where we want to be. There are a few others which are just oddly erratic. And in fact, when I was on the plane here, I took Scott's latest data set, loaded into a SQL Server database, did a bunch of comparison to old stuff and new stuff, and then checked some results when I got home and I had connections again. And I think there are a couple of things with his crawler we've got to look into. Sorry, Scott, you don't know this yet. but they're things like, and in fact, I'm saying this publicly because all his crawler data is public. So you can go to crawler.ninja. I don't know why he picked a .ninja domain, but anyway. You can go to crawler.ninja and download all the data that we use for this. So you can see his raw data. But there's stuff like one of the Chinese sites. I put it in my notes because this is what I'm going to talk to him about when he gets up. Sina.com.cn, so S-I-N-A.com.cn, is the largest site to drop off in the latest crawl, but I still don't have that as redirecting to HTTPS. So if I go to Sina.com now in my browser, that is definitely not secure. No arguments there. One of the biggest US ones was my Shopify.com. Now, this is where I think his crawler is having a bit of a hiccup. If I go to my Shopify.com, I actually get a 404. It's interesting, actually. It does return a web page that's branded with full HTML markup. Sorry, this shop is currently offline, but the response code it returns is a 404. This is over HTTP. This should still be on the list. And I have a feeling that his crawler is saying if it doesn't see 200, then it... Let me rephrase it. I think he's saying if his crawler returns 200 to an HTTP request, then it goes on the list. But if it's returning 404 over HTTP and all the content's there, well, it should still be on the list. So I'm going to talk to him about that because what I really want to do is, as I was saying before, sort of celebrate the stuff that's improving. So I would love to be able to say, hey, we've just updated all the stats. These websites have now just dropped off. I don't want to say that for my Shopify and then someone goes, no, it hasn't, because that is definitely, unequivocally, a false positive. So we have to sort that out. So I'm going to talk to him about that. Now, that's the first bit. Now, country. So here's the other really hard thing. I, in my naivety, thought that it probably isn't going to be too hard to figure out which country different websites are from. So, for example, Alexa has that information. You can grab that from Alexa. But part of the problem with that is you've got stuff like Cambridge Press, which is like the press arm of Cambridge University, flagging as Chinese. And I believe what's happening here is that Alexa is saying, let's look at where the majority of the traffic is coming from, and that will indicate the origin. That has a whole bunch of screwy problems with it. And those screwy problems obviously include things like the Cambridge situation where there's lots of traffic. It also includes things where there's like some really weird torrent sites that are predominantly turning up in places like the Netherlands. And I'm not quite sure how Alexa's doing that categorization. I don't think it's just Dutch people like doing a lot of torrenting. I think there are other things at play here. I have tried doing things like looking at TLDs, but you just can't trust TLDs. So for example, the .tv TLD, which is this like little Polynesian island, which is a nation state with 10,000 people or something in it. That has a lot of domains using .tv because, hey, doesn't .tv sound cool? You know, like if we're going to put something that's going to be videos, let's call it .tv. So we really can't trust the country definitions as well. And I don't think that there will ever be one reliable canonical list. Because even, like, think about Have I Been Pwned. What country should Have I Been Pwned be against? Should it be Australia because I'm Australian? Or because it's run by, I've got an illegal Australian entity that runs it? You know, should it be that? Well, not really, because Australia is, like, I think, the fourth or fifth largest user of the service. Should it be US because it's hosted in the US? Should it be US because most of the traffic comes from the US? So you see what I mean? It's not an exact science. And frankly, to some extent, it kind of doesn't matter because regardless of where it is, it should be HTTPS. Have I Been Pwned? Obviously is. Other sites, not so much. So the country thing is very unreliable. Countries are the one exception where I have been manually editing records because what I'm finding is that there's a bit of like nationalistic sentiment that comes through. So I will see people in Italy, for example, say, hey, there's Vodafone and there was another one as well. We'd really like you guys to go HTTPS, you know, and this nationalistic sentiment pops up and they sort of pick this up and own it in Italy and say, let's fix this. Incidentally, that one is now actually HTTPS. It may have even been before, and it could have been the crawler just saying funny things. But I have actually confirmed that it has dropped off Scott's latest crawl legitimately. So I'll look forward to celebrating their removal from the list. Now, let's move on to the controversial bits. As with anything that anybody does online, people will hate it no matter what it is. It could be fluffy kittens. There will be people who will be upset. Let's talk about levels of upsetness. And one of the first ones that came up, and I did expect this would happen when I saw the data, is Taiwan. Now, Taiwan is an interesting situation. And I've had a couple of trips to Taiwan, so I've had a bit of a chance to sort of see how people feel about this. There is, what's the right word? A bit of bad blood between Taiwan and China. So China is convinced that Taiwan is a province of China. Taiwan is convinced that they are entirely independent. They don't really see eye to eye on this. In case you're not sort of aware of the geography, Taiwan is an island. So it is some distance away from China. It's literally a landlocked country or province, depending on where you're from. So there's obviously a bunch of issues there. They've had civil wars and stuff like that in the past. In fact, one of the girls in my talk yesterday afternoon was from Taiwan, and the subject came up, and she said, look, the civil wars basically never ended. Now, here's the problem. I am relying on two character ISO country codes. There's an ISO standard, which I think is like ISO 3601 or something like that, which defines a two character country code, such as AU, and then the name of the country, such as Australia. And Wikipedia has a great list. There's also the ISO standards everywhere else. It defines the country name for TW, being Taiwan, as Taiwan, province of China. And I saw this and I went, oh, this isn't going to go well. I shouldn't laugh, actually, because it is a very, very serious issue for people in Taiwan. And I kind of went, it's official definitions, let's load it. Now, of course, I got multiple comments very, very early. I got emails, I got Twitters from people that were upset. And I'm saying, look, I get where you're coming from, but it is really difficult for me to take some authoritative, and look, even there's arguments about whether ISO standards are authoritative or not, but take what is believed to be a canonical list of countries and codes and things, and then say, some people don't like this definition, it should be changed to something else. Because even if I did change it, then I'd probably upset Chinese people who'd go, well, hang on a moment, this is not the correct term. So I've sort of pushed back on this consistently and said, look, I don't want to get into like geopolitics about which country owns what and all this sort of other stuff. I'm just going to go with the ISO list. Yeah, just absolute neutral. I have no opinion on it. It's going to make some people happy, some people upset. This has got nothing to do with HTTPS. This is just one of the sorts of things which injected itself into the discussions this week. Couple of other things. There were some people responsible for sites that ended up on the list that were not happy about them being on the list. It wasn't that they weren't happy about them being on the list because they were a false positive. They were not happy with them being on the list because, frankly, I think they don't like being shamed. Now, there is, an entire discussion to be had around shaming. And I think when done constructively, it's actually very productive. And I'm going to explain why in another post. I actually have a draft on this. I've got many, many examples of where it's led to really positive changes. In one particular case, one of the big Aussie ones is a forum called Whirlpool. And Whirlpool's been around for quite a while, a lot of tech discussions. Occasionally I end up there via searches and that sort of thing. They are not redirecting requests to the root of the site to HTTPS. The owner of that site got very, very cranky and said a lot of very, not very nice things on Whirlpool itself and then on the Twitters too. There is an easy way to fix this. Do it right. Now, he made a bunch of arguments about HSTS and things like this, but there is one thing that every site needs to do if they don't want to be on the list. If you make an HTTP request to the host name itself, it must redirect. Even if it takes a couple of hops, so maybe you go to whirlpool.net.au and then it goes to www.whirlpool.net.au and then it goes to HTTPS. Like, that's fine. Like, we end up there on that first request. Regardless of your HSTS status, regardless of preload, regardless of include subdomains, all the other constructs you've got, that has to happen. And in fact, if you're not doing that, you can't preload anyway, because one of the conditions of preload is that you must 301 from the naked domain all the way through to HTTPS. So frankly, when I start to see people behaving like that, and it was pretty aggressive, some of it, it's like, look, just move on. It's just not worth the energy. So on that note, we're going to move on because that's not worth the energy. So one of the other things that that came up a few times was HSTS. Now, HSTS is awesome. You should HSTS all of your things. Wherever possible, you should include subdomains, which will then also include you to preload. Some people raised the fact that I'm not preloading on troyhunt.com. It's because I still have hackyourselffirst.troyhunt.com, which I use for my workshops, to show vulnerabilities with serving traffic insecurely. I have a domain called hackyourselffirst1st, which is intended to replace it. I have been trying in vain through GoDaddy. Yeah, big surprise, something in vain through GoDaddy. To purchase hackyourselffirst, F-I-R-S-T, because in my mind, at least, that makes a lot more sense and someone's just domain squatting. That's not going to work. I think I've just got to get off my backside and just go, okay, hackyourselff1st, you're going to be the new domain, roll everything over to that. Then I can add include subdomains, then I can add preload, and I can do it properly as well. Because there is a gap in my implementation, and I need to do a better job of that too, regardless of the reasons why it's there. So I'll get that sorted out. Another argument that I've seen come up in the general HTTPS discussions, and someone very, very enthusiastically raised this in my presentation yesterday afternoon, is that HTTPS can block clients that don't support HTTPS. Now, I've said that a bit deadpan because I know it sounds kind of obvious, but it begs the question, which clients do not support HTTPS? Now, I'm not just going to single out this one person who raised the issues yesterday because I have seen it raised by other people as well. But his point was, well, if you've got a browser from 1995. Now, let's just think through this for a moment. If you have a browser from 1995, you are not doing much browsing. You are not going to be browsing any of the world's biggest websites because many of the world's biggest ones, and let's just be clear, the top 10 biggest, actually Baidu may be the exception, but certainly Facebook, Twitter, eBay, Amazon, all of these major things are all HTTPS. You're not doing any banking. That's HTTPS. You're probably not doing any shopping. That's HTTPS. You're probably not doing any online email. That's all HTTPS. If you have a client that can't talk HTTPS, you're not doing anything. You're not going to miss anything. Trust me. So that's just like one of these odd, bizarre arguments. But you know, some people do come up with that. So moving on. Path forward for whynohttps.com. I do want to get those stats updated, but they have to be reliable. If they're not reliable, people lose confidence in the service. And I'd rather give it another day or two or three or however long it takes for Scott to make sure that that crawler has figures that are representative of the experience people have when they go to the site. We'll do what we have to do, but we will get it updated. I think I'm going to try and add a little bit more information about how to go and get HTTPS, because in my sort of cocooned world, I was thinking, well, people have seen HTTPS as easy.com and things like that, but I want to explicitly put those references there. The other thing I want to do, we'll call this medium term, is I want categorizations. Now, I had originally planned to do this because I thought it would be easy, but guess what's not? I had wanted to say, here's like the world's biggest airlines, here's the world's biggest banks, here's all these other sort of categorizations that allow us to see which industry sectors are not doing a good job of this. I believe I have a way of getting that now with the support from an organization that I will name later on. And if I can get that, then hopefully that will be an easy addition. So I'll probably turn that into another blog post, and then I'll make observations about which sectors kind of stand out. So hopefully I'll have that one shortly as well. Other than that, if you have any more ideas about how to surface those who are not doing this properly, like Whirlpool, then I will add that to the site because I really want to make this information visible and usable. And for everyone else, if you want to put together your own list like this, go to crawler.ninja and get Scott's data and you can do your own 1R HTTPS or help contribute to ours. That's also good. All right, so starting to wrap up. Sponsor this week is Matchlight from Terbium. So they are still lining up meetings with people that want to go and see them at the Vegas events. So Black Hat, I think they're just doing the Black Hat ones. Let's actually check. They're doing Black Hat meetings. It is in the banner of my website. Yes, they're doing Black Hat meetings. So if you're going to go see Terbium Black Hat, go to my blog and click the banner at the top. I'll put that in the notes as well. I am not going to the Vegas events. I've had just way too much travel. And also in 9 days from now, I'll be off for 3 weeks. So I'm actually going to be driving down to Sydney, where I've just come from, doing a week of events there, spending some time in Canberra as well, some government folks, going snowboarding for a week. Yes, foreigners, Australia does have snow. Then coming back and spending more time in Sydney again. So I'm actually going to be doing a bunch of domestic travel. I would love to go to the Vegas events. I still haven't been to Black Hat or DEF CON. So maybe next year I shall try and do those and I'll just plan my travel a little bit better. Thank you very much for watching this. I hope it's been useful and interesting and all those things. Please do keep feedback coming, particularly about how we can do the Why No HTTPS stuff better. And I'll come to you next week from here. See you guys.